Hello, everyone. My name is Kelvin Daniels. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kelvin.
So today, the grace of God, miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, phenomenal sponsorship in the steps. I haven't drank since October 10th, 1996. Yeah. I'd like to thank Jeff for that warm introduction. Okay, lukewarm. Jeff is a phenomenal example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll get into that. And it's just an honor and a privilege to be here this evening. And it's an honor and a privilege I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a person that shouldn't be alive, shouldn't be here, shouldn't be doing anything. And it's an honor just to be able to go anywhere. I'd like to thank the big Olies first roundup, and for having me come out tonight. I really appreciate it, and I want to thank Josh, who's been a great host so far, and Dewey, and I tell you, it's a funny thing, because they took us out to dinner beforehand, and I get nervous at dinner, not because I'm afraid that I'm going to spill on myself or anything else like that, but because of two instances. The first one is I had spoken at a conference in Wisconsin a little over a year ago, and everything I got pushed way back time-wise. And like, well, let's hurry and go eat. And I'm like, well, it's getting short on. Well, that's all right. We got time. So I get out there and we eat real quick. And I'm giving my talk. And I had just said the drinking made me suave and debonair. And then I get this belch out. suave and debonair. Bleh. And I was like, did that really just happen? And and it was just like, oh, man. So I hate eating right before I talk. And then the other thing is I just talked at a conference up in Canada in January, and it was one of these big dinner conferences for Saturday night, and everybody comes in, and you eat beforehand, and they sit me up by all these, you know, normal people, you know, them. And it's a pastor, and I'm like, oh, man. I haven't been to church in a long time, so I'm guilty right now. And then they have me next to the mayor and his wife, and I'm like, I ain't never sat next to mayors and wives before. This is kind of nice. And then right down the end is a high-ranking officer in the Royal Mounted Canadian Police. And I'm sitting there going, if you only knew. And so right as I'm sitting there eating, and this didn't happen here, thank God, because it puts a lot of pressure on you, but right as I'm getting ready to start eating, this guy comes walking up to me from across the room from where the banquets are, because they have us sit up to the front. And he comes walking up to me and he goes, hi, my name's Ron. I go, hi, Ron. He goes, you're a speaker tonight? And I said, yep. He said, just want to let you know, I paid $20 to get in here. It better not be a disappointment. And I sat right there and I was like, Ron, I hope you enjoyed the food. And it's, and afterward, the guy came walking towards me coming through the line. I started reaching for my wallet and he goes, no, man, it's all right. It's like homecoming coming here, getting a chance to spend some time with Jeff, who lives in a different town than I do, and just a great chance to catch up with him and see Roger and Ellie and Chad and Josh and Dewey. And it was a funny thing because before I'd actually met Dewey, I'd heard about Dewey. And what I had heard about Dewey, there was a member of our group named Kane that's no longer with us, and Kane had shared this story with us about how funny it was that he had peed on this roommate of his. That was Dewey. So I walk in, I see the guy, and I'm going, you know. So it's a beautiful thing, and hopefully I don't have to make amends for that later. I've been getting those disapproving looks my whole life, Dewey. Don't think it matches now. But I tell you what, it's a wonderful thing to be in Alcoholics Anonymous today, and it's a wonderful thing to see the people that I love and the people that I care about and be able to share my lives with them. And I grew up on the Minot Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota. And, yeah, if they only knew. And I grew up on this Air Force Base, and automatically I was different. And alcoholics feel different to begin with when they come into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I felt extremely different because we had never been stationed anywhere else but Minot. So I was born in Minot, I was raised in Minot, and everybody else had been to like France and Spain, and these other cool European countries, or down south somewhere, and they had all these great stories. And what I learned at an early age was, if you lie, it's a real good thing. And I sat there, and these kids were telling all these stories, and I've got a great memory. You know, I'm one of those guys, when it comes to something that's not important, you know. My head's full of useless facts by the mile, you know. And I remember being on two blocks over, and I lived on Winding Way, and Winding Way was the biggest street on the base. And we got over there, and there was these other kids down there, and they were telling these stories about Germany and how they had drank beer when they were there and stuff. So I'm in my front yard, and these other kids are telling me all these great places they were, and I got out from that front yard, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, remember that story? Those kids probably don't hang out with those kids. So I start telling these kids how I'd been to Germany and how I had drank beer and done all this stuff, and I didn't know that my kitchen window was open. My mom was in there listening. All I heard was, Calvin! And I had this great big afro, and that's what she used to take me into the house, and... It was like a handle. That's why I shaved my head today. You know, I'm not going to let nobody snatch me into the house again. And I got a lesson on being honest that day. And what I had found out was by that experience is that these kids thought I was cool. And I learned early age, if I can make you like me, that's a good thing. And I just never felt enough when I was growing up. It was like I had this hole in my gut. And when people look at me, you don't look at me, you look through somebody like me. Because I'm shallow and I'm hollow and I'm empty by nature. So when you look at me, you don't look at me, you look through me. And I don't fit in well with you, and I don't mesh with you. And man, they have money, and my parents don't have money. And we lived in the commissioned officer's court. We lived in the NCO, the non-commissioned officer court. My dad was a sergeant. And the officer's kids were right down the block from us, you know? So they always had the good stuff and everything else. And I felt less than when I was around them. And I remember feeling that way growing up, you know? I don't think that I was an alcoholic when I was born. I know that I had the disease of alcoholism from the day I was born. I remember being irritable, restless, and discontent my entire life. I remember things weren't good enough. And if you didn't cheer when I walked in the room, that I felt less than. And I remembered all those things, you know, and I remember just not being able to sit still, and I was restless, and uncomfortable in my own skin. And I remember how that feels, and I remember that from as early as I can remember my childhood. And that had nothing to do with my parents. It had nothing to do with the fact that we were in the military. It had nothing to do with the way I was raised. It was something inside of me that I couldn't quite put my finger on. Ironically, when I had a chance to drink, an alcoholic was born. All the thing else I had done and everything else that I had partaken with, all of those things in my life, all those things made sense to a certain point once I got a chance to drink. Because then I could understand, oh, this is the missing picture. And before I got a chance to drink, I just muddled through life. And I remembered I would just search for something. I was trying to find something inside of me I felt wormy inside. And I have the retrospect to look back now, because hindsight's always 20/20. But when I was then, I just didn't feel right. And I remembered that movies, when VHSs came out, or betas, or laser discs, or whatever the heck that stuff was, and first time you could watch movies at home and not have to go to the movie theater, you know? I remember that they had all these movies and stuff, and my dad brought home movies. And when my dad brought home movies, my life changed the day he brought home Scarface, you know? I was like, man, you know? And my mom was yelling at my dad, saying, you shouldn't let him watch that! And I was like, so he waited for her to go to bed. And I started watching Scarface, and I got excited. I was like, man, this guy's powerful. He's got tigers in his lawn. And at the end of it, say hello to my little friend. Boom, and he blows everybody up. And I'm like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a drug lord, and I'm 7, you know? And that's what I need. I need power. I need power, you know? And man, I got excited about that. And I idolized people, too. I don't know if anybody else did that, but I idolized people. And back then, when I was growing up, the big performer that time was Michael Jackson. And I know that might be a little controversial right now. And I don't want to be Michael right now, but back then, that day, when Michael was still black, he was cool. And I remembered I watched Billie Jean, the video of Billie Jean, and he's going down the sidewalk, and little sidewalk pieces are lighting up and everything, and Beat It and Thriller, and I was like, man, if I could just be Michael Jackson. So I went home that night, and I begged my parents. We went over to the BX on base, it was the base exchange, and I got one of those patent leather red jackets with the zippers that don't go anywhere, you know? And I got me some penny loafer shoes and some black jeans and white socks, because Michael had those bunched up white socks. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, yeah, it looks pretty good. And I had, like, I still had this big fro. So I broke into my dad's hair supplies and I'm putting Afro Sheen on and everything else. And I got stuff just dripping off my head, you know? And I, finishing touch, I pulled that little curly cue down the middle, you know, right there. And I was like, yeah, that's it. Something's missing though. One white glove. So I got myself one white glove. And I went to school like that the next day. There is something about a man that can go, ee-hee, and women go crazy. When you're in fifth grade and you go, ee-hee, guys come running at you to beat you up, not women. And I was just like, oh, this isn't working out, man. I'm supposed to get mobbed by women. These guys want to beat me up. This isn't cool, you know. And I was like, oh, crushed again, you know. And grade school was painful for me, you know, and just painful. Sixth grade was a turning point in my life, you know. I had bad behavior problems because, you know, people were good kids and they got attention. And I couldn't get attention being a good kid or being a smart kid. So I decided to be a bad kid, you know. And what that ended up happening to me was in sixth grade, my desk sat in the front of the class angled just enough so I could see the chalkboard away from the rest of the students. And I had this guy named Mr. Nelson that was on my resentment list, ironically. And I didn't know that in sixth grade I was already going to be forming this resentment list. You know, it's good to know that I have something to do with it now today in AA. But this guy had, Valentine's Day came around. And he said, you guys are going into seventh grade next year. So nobody has to give a Valentine they don't want to. You guys are going to have to learn to be grown up. So now mention this resentment list I said I had. I went home and I was excited because there was people in my class I just did not like. This girl Jen, this other girl Sarah, and all basically the girls that I had asked out at the dance and they told me no. And things like that hurt me. People don't realize, but I've got a lot of love to give. And people just didn't realize that when I was growing up. And what ended up happening was is I got home and I started writing this list out of people. My mom goes, oh, isn't that nice? You're putting your Valentines together. And I'm like, nope, these are the people that aren't getting one. And so I'm writing this list out and my mom says this to me. Kelvin, how would you feel if somebody didn't give you a Valentine? Let me tell you how it feels. I had spent 3 days on my Valentine's box. G.I. Joes were big back then, so I had G.I. Joes on top of my Valentine's box shooting each other. They had the kung fu grip, you know, and they were doing this thing. I had them in poses and everything, and I was excited. So I took this Valentine's box and I put it on my desk, you know, and I'm positioning it like 3 times to make sure that the load-bearing weight of my desk is going to be able to handle the onslaught of Valentines I'm going to get. And the teacher goes, all right, ready? Go. And I took off out of my desk, and I'm going around, and I drop one in all these people. And as I'm dropping them in there, I'm thinking of these people I don't like, and I'm thinking of what my mom said, you know, and drop, 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 drop. And I rush back to my desk, and I grab my box, and I pick it up, and it's a little light. Oh, man, I tear the top off. I didn't get one. Not even from the teacher. And I told that story at a talk I gave in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and it was right before Valentine's Day. On February 14th, the front door to my house, I open it up. A sponsee of mine had just came over, Zach, and I go down to letting him in the front door, and he comes walking in with this big FedEx package. And he's like, what's this? I don't know. And I tear this thing open, and it's full of little kid Valentines, you know? I mean, people's kids had written them. I think I saw a paw print on one. I mean, it was just like they made this thing a family affair. So the Eau Claire Pacific Group had came through and healed my childhood hurt. So you never know what you're going to get in AA. And it was just one thing after another like that. And the next year, yeah, it was seventh grade. And things were going on. And what ended up happening was is I just remember feeling afraid, and I remember not feeling enough, and all those things, because I'm the kind of person, I compare my insides to your outsides. And I will never match up to that. No matter what, I will never feel as good inside as you people look. So when that guy has that, and when she has this, and when she's dating him, and when their parents have money, I'm not going to match up. There's a hole that's in my gut that I need this approval, and I look at you people for it, and you look better than I feel. So automatically, I feel like I don't match up. And I just remember this just innate feeling of just, all the time, just, like I couldn't take it. I couldn't stand to be right where those people were. And when I was about 13 years old, I got a chance to drink, and that changed all those things. I got a chance to drink when I was 13, and it was a magical experience. I got a chance to drink, and it changed my perception of all of those things. All of a sudden, these people that seem like they look better than me, they're no longer better than me. You know, they're just lucky I'm here, you know? And these ladies, especially those ones in sixth grade who had turned me down at the dance, they'd be lucky if I talked to them. And it was just one of those things, and I just knew. I knew right then and there that this feeling that I had, it made me feel so much better, that filled me up, that hole in my gut slammed shut like the winds of a hurricane blowing down a door. It was done. And I was like, yes. And I could come out and play. And I could stand there, and I could kick my shoulders back a little bit. And I didn't get chubby until I got older. So when I was little, I was only 5'4 and 120 pounds in seventh grade. I know it's hard for some of you to believe. Most people think I came out of the womb like that. But I was small. And all of a sudden, I got buff, you know?
Yeah.
You know? And I was just standing there, and I looked good, you know? I looked real good. And that fro, it got nice. And the Jerry curl was perfect. And all of those things, everything came together. It was like I had spent my whole life prior to that trying to be this square peg fitting into the round hole. And all of a sudden, I became right sized and right shaped, and I just fit right in. And I just slid in, and I was home, and I was free. And I didn't have to be afraid. And it didn't matter what anybody thought, and it didn't matter what anybody had. And all of a sudden, I just felt good. And I couldn't figure that out. I was like, man, this is what I've been missing. You know? And my dad watched Westerns and stuff, and John Wayne drank, you know? So I can be like him, and shoot people. Jeff mentioned I'm unstable. I was unstable. And I just remember that. I remember that feeling. And that feeling I got that first night, that I got the effect from alcohol, is the same feeling I chased until the day that I quit. To the day that I quit drinking, that is the same effect, that first feeling of yes, is the same thing that I chased all the way through to the end, and I couldn't ever get back to. I got close, but it seems like I overshot the mark. I'm a habitual line stepper. If you put a line in front of me, I'm not just stepping over it, man. If that's the end of a cliff, I'm going to pretend like I know how to fly, you know? I'm going right over it because I'm a person of extremes. A little bit isn't good enough for me. I will jump over the end of that thing every single time. That's what happens with people like me. And I just, yes, this is what I need. And the problem is when you're 13, you can't drink all the time. When you're 13, you don't have the accessibility to be putting down the kegs, you know? So I got it as often as I could. And the entire time that I didn't have it, I would think about how I felt. And I would think about all of those things. And people seemed to notice me when I drank. And I seemed to be able to play sports better. And all those things came together for me. And I didn't have consequences right away. If I could drink the way I drank when I first started off, you'd have a different speaker tonight. I didn't have the consequences. I hadn't burned my life to the ground. I haven't destroyed everybody around me yet. I'm just having fun, you know? I can't be in trouble right now because I'm just having a little bit of fun. And I felt that way, and I was like, yes, this is what I need. And I went through school, and I struggled. And it just seemed that when I could drink, everything was fine. And when I couldn't drink, everything wasn't fine. And I went through identity crises, you know, hair crises. And, you know, when in eighth grade, Kid and Play was a big thing. And a lot of you in here don't know who that is. But it was this guy that wore his hair in this little afro box straight up in the air, like 12 inches high. So I cut the fro into this big box, you know. Only I left the bangs on the front. So I look like a defunct ship. And then it was in style where you were supposed to cut all these lines in your hair, you know? So I spent like 3 hours putting a checkerboard in it one day, you know? And I expected people to think that was cool. It was another Michael Jackson situation. People were just like, that looks dumb, you know? You know? That hurt my feelings, you know? I'm a feeler by nature. And I couldn't stand it when people would look at me like that. And when I got into my drinking heavy and when I started doing that stuff, when I started burning my life to the ground, when I started hurting all these people, you'd get those looks from people. And it's the look, when I look at him, don't look at me like that. Just don't. Because that I can't stand the disapprovement. I can't stand you not liking me. I can't stand to think that I failed. I can't stand those feelings. Don't look at me that way. And I would start to lash out. And I got real angry. And I started to fight. And I became this dysfunctional kid. Because the feelings that were inside of me, if I could beat you down enough, maybe you'd feel like me. And I got dangerous. And I started hurting people. And I started doing things wrong. And as I'm drinking, people are saying, man, you should, I'm getting into high school and stuff. People are like, you should stop that stuff, man. You're out of control, Daniels. What is wrong with you? And I just wanted to shake them and say, don't you understand? This makes me, I wanted to say that, but I couldn't say that. I was just like, nah, man, that was their fault. You know, trust me, man, the next time we go out, I'm not going to do that. And what I didn't realize is that was the first part of my disease. That was that mental obsession of the mind. That was that thing that sat on my shoulder and told me it was okay to drink. And that the consequences and the people, that was their problem and it wasn't me. And it was the thing that justified the bad behavior. It was the thing that said, man, it's okay if you go steal things from people so you can buy booze. You know? They can afford it. They're rich. You know? And I justified that. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's fine. You know? And it was the thing that told me that, you know what, man? You don't have to stop because you don't have a problem. And I just remember that feeling, and I remember sitting there going, yeah, I don't have a problem. These people have a problem. And I'm a real good one at pointing my finger at people. Problem is, every time I do that, there seems to be three more of them coming right back at me. And I, man, it was your fault. Because if I blame you, and it's your fault, then I don't have to look at my own actions. I don't have to look at my consequences. I don't have to have the problem, because it becomes yours now. And I remember justifying that early on, thinking, if these people didn't think about these things, if these people didn't overreact, I wouldn't have a problem. And I remember just feeling that way, you know. And I started getting in trouble, and I had this car, and I thought a lot, you know. I was one of those guys that I'd get angry and I'd fight because I couldn't stand the way people were looking at me. And I had these personalized plates in my car, and I started glorifying that because I was validating myself as a man. And I got these personalized plates that said beat down on them. And I figured if you came around me and you didn't act the way I wanted you to, and if you looked at me wrong, you were going to pay the price. Because that was the only thing I could do to fill that hole that was in my gut. Because I'm already starting to not get full enough from the booze. And I just started hurting people. And I started doing that kind of stuff. And I was, man, you know. And if I didn't drink, I'd start getting a little crazy. So I quit drinking, and I figured if I quit drinking, I wouldn't have the problems, and I wouldn't fight anymore, and I wouldn't do those things, and I wouldn't hurt my family, my mom wouldn't cry, and all these things wouldn't happen if I quit drinking. Well, I quit drinking for a couple weeks. All those problems were still there. And that's the second part of my disease, that phenomenon of craving. That develops in me when I take that drink. When I take a drink of alcohol, that thing clicks on, and it says, get some more, Jack, get it now, let's roll, you know? Because I know what's coming. I know that it's time to go. I know that it's time to feel okay. It's time to be able to look you in the eye and not feel afraid. And towards the end of my drinking, I didn't even have to have the thing in my mouth yet. And when I cracked the top off that beer and it went, ksh, I was like, yeah. And I'd feel relaxed and I'd feel okay. Just from the sound of that, because I knew what was going to happen next. I knew it was going to be tipping that thing up and I knew it was going to be okay. I'm not a guy who bad raps alcohol. Alcohol to me was the most beautiful thing on the planet. When that beer got slid across the table at me, and the sweat's coming down it, it's like a newborn baby's tears. That's beautiful, you know? That's the way I look at alcohol. When you hold a bottle of Jack Daniels just right and the sun hits it, you can forget those little mosaic little, you know, stained glass windows and churches and stuff, man. This is really beautiful, you know? We should just have I want to go to the church of Jack Daniels, you know? I mean, you put that up behind the altar and I'll be paying attention all day long, you know? Just waiting for it to get over because it's go time, you know? That's me, you know? I thought alcohol was beautiful. And I couldn't understand it when people started not drinking like me. Because these people weren't drinking like me, some of them. They were putting ice in their drinks. What? The ice gets in the way, man. You know, John Wayne never had ice in a shot glass. If he did, he wouldn't have any teeth, you know. Clang, you know, and there'd be chipped teeth. There'd be nothing left, you know. And I was like, I'm going to drink like that. That makes sense to me, you know. That stuff, umbrellas and drinks, what, is it going to rain, you know? I don't need that, you know. And I don't want your fruity drinks, your wine coolers, you know, until I run out. I will not be picky. If you've got, and the thing is, I drink fine wines, Thunderbird, Night Train, Mad Dog 2020. Those are fine wines to me because they're cheap and they get you there quick, you know. And I'd heard a speaker talk about it. She'd been sober like 30-some years. She talked about drinking Ripple. And I never got to drink Ripple. But I was new, and I was like, I got to find some Ripple, you know. Because Ripple sounds way better than Mad Dog 2020, and it probably doesn't do what it does to my stomach afterwards either. Not like that. And I just was like, yeah, it's go time. That's the kind of stuff I want. And after I got sober for a while, I started watching what normal people do and what the way they drink. And it really bugs me. Bad. I can't stand the way normal people drink. My wife, normal. My father-in-law, well, my wife can't be totally normal because she married me. But my father-in-law, mother-in-law, sister-in-law, all of them, normal. Normal drinkers, they can have two and stop. I don't like people like that, you know? And I remember I start counting drinks. I'm at an employee Christmas party, and I'll start counting the drinks that that guy's having, the guy who's quiet in the office, and he starts getting a little loose, you know? And I'm like, two more, and he's going to be right there, baby. I know where you want to go to a meeting? You know, that's just the way I get. And I start counting people's drinks, and my sister-in-law had two beers, okay? I count. And she had two beers, and she went back into the house and disappeared, and she came up with this big glass of water. And I looked at her and I said, didn't you just have a beer? And she goes, yeah, but, and it was like 90 degrees. She goes, but it's really hot out here and I'm starting to get lightheaded. And I'm like, drink! What the heck is wrong with you? The magic's getting ready to happen. You're not going to feel hot anymore. Put about six more of them down. You'll be cool all day. Go for it, you know? And my mother-in-law is looking at me like, what did my daughter do? And my father-in-law is going, oh, just walked away. And I'm like, because he's the kind of guy, he'll nurse like a little thing of sifter of brandy, you know? I don't understand people that buy special glasses to drink out of, you know? I drink out of the bottle, man, you know? That's the kind of drinking I do. That's the kind of drinking I relate to. And that's what I did. And I understand that kind of drinking. I understand that kind of feeling. I understand what it means to just drink purely for the effect. And the book tells me that men and women drink essentially for the effect that's produced by alcohol. And the funny thing is that when I look at these other people, they don't seem to be getting in trouble. And the book then tells me that the drinks I see others take with impunity, and that the sense of restless irritability and discontentment that happens in me doesn't subside until I have a few of those drinks. And I see these other people, and they're drinking without consequence. They're drinking. They don't seem to have the problems. They're not getting in the fights. Their family isn't having trouble. They're not going to jail. None of those things are happening for them. And I can't understand why they seem to be drinking as much as I do, and they don't have the problem. It's because I have a peculiar mental twist that happens in my head. The book tells me I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Bodily, I'm different because of the phenomenon of craving. Mentally, I'm different because of the mental obsession of the mind. And I will judge every single part of that and justify it, because if it's you, it doesn't have to be me. And that makes sense now. Back then, it didn't. And I started having problems. I did really well in sports, and I had 27 scholarship offers across the United States. Had a congressional nomination to the Air Force Academy. I was a D1 prospect. I was a machine back then. And I don't say that out of ego. It was just, I was a machine back then, you know? And I was going for it. I was like, yes, I'm going to be on national TV. I'm going to be waving to mom on national TV. That's going to be me, you know? And all I had to do was score 2 points higher on this one exam. I don't know how y'all handle pressure, but the night before that exam, I was like, I'm just going to have a couple, just to calm down, you know? I'm going to have just a couple, just to calm my nerves. I can think a little better when I'm drinking, too, because I seem to get real intelligent when I'm drunk, you know? I can discuss astrophysics, you know, brain surgery. Oh, you don't think so? We can crack your head open right here and practice. I'm a brain surgeon, you know? And I get focused that way, and I'm good to go, you know? So one or two turned into 5:30 in the morning, and my test was at 7:30, and I didn't make it, you know? And I was like, man, I'm a loser. I am a loser. You know, all these dreams, all these hopes, and my mom had had started calling like Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine because I was really seriously going to be the first native-born black North Dakotan to go to the Air Force Academy. I didn't know when they started checking and keeping track of who was native-born or not or anything else like that, but it was, I was supposed to be it. So, I mean, I've got write-ups in the paper and everything else, and I fall out of it. And I'm like, man, you're a loser. And I just felt bad. I don't know what you do when you feel like that, but I drink more. And I just kept going down the path. And the thing is that I had this high set of, the book talks about moral and philosophical convictions galore, and I had them. They were right there. And it just seemed that the more stuff I did, another notch would come off of it. All right, I'll look at it if this happens. That happened the next day. Okay, well, if I start doing this stuff, you know, because I looked at drugs as being bad, you know, I was a drinker, you know, that was for the losers, you know, the losers did drugs and stuff, you know, I drank, you know, and all of a sudden somebody was like, try this, and I was like, drunk enough to say, okay, you know, so I jump on board with that, and I'm like, man, I can use this stuff to manage my drinking a little bit, this is great, you know, so I start getting into some of that kind of stuff, and I was like, man, this is wonderful, which ended up twisting my mind a little bit when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I sat down with my sponsor and I explained to him I was going to be a drug-addicted alcoholic. And he said, oh, really? And he said, Kelvin, you can't do that. And I said, why? I said, I did a lot of drugs, did all that kind of stuff. And he said, I'm not going to allow you to separate yourself from the base of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, so you're telling me that you not only have alcoholism, but you got something else that's wrong with you that makes you worse than me. You got something else wrong with you that is going to make you so much different that you have to handle that. He said, if drugs were just your problem, if that was the case, if you were really a drug addict, if those things are really going on, if you quit doing that stuff, you wouldn't have a problem. Guess what? You have alcoholism that underlies all that stuff. You'll put anything in your system to make yourself feel better. And that just hides the symptoms of my alcoholism. And I was like, okay. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, well, what would end up happening then? You know, if I got up here and actually started saying, announcing what was wrong with me, I'd be just getting done with my introduction, you know. Hi, my name's Kelvin Daniels. I'm a drug-addicted alcoholic, gambling addict, sex addict. I like dressing up and get my butt spanked. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to say, you know. You know, I like medium-rare red meat, you know. I mean, I'm addicted to Eau Claire's and cream puffs and cheesecake, you know. What am I going to keep going on? You know, I'd be just getting done, you know. I can't separate myself from Alcoholics Anonymous, and he wouldn't allow me to do that. Thank God he wouldn't allow me to do that. I had a bad enough trouble trying to separate myself from the rest of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a bad enough trouble sitting there saying, you know what, man, yeah, that may work for you guys. And I remember the day that I really found out that there was nothing different for me than anyone else in AA. I was at work, and there was a guy, and he was on me. And this guy hated me, and he was racist. And one day he was driving away and he threw out that N-word. And that was Thursday night, and it was the night of my home group, and I was mad because I didn't have a car and I could only run so fast, and that car moved way faster than I could run. And I couldn't throw very far when I was that winded, so the rocks weren't getting there either, you know. And I got to the meeting and I'm like, I got one for him. He doesn't know what to do with this one. I come walking up and I'm like, Jeff, this is what this guy said to me, and I'm going to kill him tomorrow when I see him. And he said, oh, really? Why don't you go ahead and do that? And I was like, really? He goes, no, you jackass. And I started launching on my tirade because I had it planned out, because by this time I had a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous who had started to try to change my thinking a little bit. And I had it all planned out. And I'm like, don't give me your AA spiritual crap on this one. You do not know what it's like to be called that. And he said, really? You don't think that I know what it's like to have people hurt my feelings and make me feel less than? And I was like, oh, man. I hate it when he's right. And he wouldn't let me beat that guy up. I hated that. And my life was crashing. It was burning to the ground. And I had a failed suicide attempt, and I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. First meeting I walked into was on a Thursday night, and I had sobered up in the Thursday night group. And I walked in the meeting that night, and it was on a Thursday. I hadn't showered since Sunday. I hadn't cut my hair in, I don't know, a couple, 3 months. I hadn't shaved in I don't know how long. And And I worked concrete, so I had little pieces of concrete in my hair, you know, and stuff. And there was no cool water cologne covering up the funk coming off my body, you know. I stunk. And my hair was horrible. It was like I was a chia pet on crack or something, you know. It's all over the place. And that's why I came to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, was just like that. And I walked into that first meeting, and this guy, Kenny, gets up, and he starts telling his story. And he gets up, and he starts telling his story, and I'm like, man, what is going on? You know, scared the crap out of me. And I, because he was talking about how I was feeling. And I couldn't get over that. And I did what any sensible newcomer would do. I waited until he got done talking, and I was out, you know. I grabbed some pamphlets so I could show my parents I had been to a meeting. And I went out, you know. And I left from there, and I went over to my buddy's house, and I grabbed that first beer, and I cracked the top off. And the funny thing is that feeling didn't happen right then. Because by this time in my drinking, I'm not drinking to get, I'm drinking to be able to breathe or look you in the eye. I'm drinking just to survive by this time in my drinking. That's where I'm at. That's where the disease, that's where the four horsemen were at my bed every morning. Every morning they were there, and I had to chase them away with putting something in my system to get rid of them. Because I couldn't face them. I was doing such horrible things when I drank and hurting so many people. I'd been in over 250 street fights. And I would just beat people to the ground, and I would say things to people and humiliate them just to try to make myself feel better. And when you're drinking like that, I'm drinking because I'm drinking. Because when I get up in the morning, I got to get those memories out of my head. And I want to put enough booze on board the night before, because blackouts, I welcomed them because I didn't have to remember the stuff that I did the night before, and I could maybe have somewhat of a conscience the next day and not have to be so afraid. And I went after it, and I just... It was killing me. And I cracked the top off that first one, and I threw it down. And I cracked the top on that second one. I don't even think I finished it, because the only thing going through my head was, man, you were a loser. You were a D1 prospect. And there's nothing wrong with working concrete. I did it for a lot of years after that sober. But you're working concrete. You're supposed to be on national TV. Man, you're a loser. Nobody wants you around. Your family doesn't even want you around. You can't do anything right. You're garbage. You're nothing. And that's the only thing that was going through my head. And that booze, that first beer, and that part of that second one didn't take it away this time. And I wanted to die. I just wanted to die. And I decided that night I was going to sober up. And my parents had left on a little trip up to Canada. And I called in sick to work that night, because the next day was Friday. And I knew that if I went back to the shop on Friday, we got hammered every Friday at the shop. And I knew I couldn't go there if I was going to stay sober. And it started right there. And my body started detoxing. I started going through the DTs. I threw up blood. I almost died on the floor of my room. And the last thing I remember going is I was sitting there shaking violently and laying on the floor. I was cleaning this ugly yellow lamp I had bought I don't even know why I mentioned this ugly yellow lamp. But I saw, that was the last thing I saw before I passed out. And the last thought I had was, God, just kill me. And it was funny that I'd said his name, because by this point in time, I grew up in church when I was a kid. I grew up, we were devout Lutherans. I was the number one graduation student for my confirmation class. I get to give the sermon the next Sunday. People afterwards came up to me after church and said, man, this is what your calling is. You're supposed to be a minister. You're supposed to deliver the word of God to people. And I was the president of the NYLF, National Lutheran Youth Fellowship League. I was in church. And the funny thing is that when I was reading the Bible with my dad said to me, I was sitting there and we got to this part, and I said I was supposed to fear God. And I didn't realize that meant respect. And I said to my dad, I said, yeah, I'm afraid of God. And he said, well, yeah. He said, every man should fear God because he's so powerful. And I said, no. I'm afraid of God. You don't understand, man. If you mess, and this is that conception I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with. If you mess up, Sodom and Gomorrah happens. He turns you into pillars of salt and he kills you. If you mess up, he floods the earth for 40 days and 40 nights and wipes you all out. If you mess up, and you get too powerful, he sends a woman in to destroy you, and he cuts your hair off. You can see what happened to me. If you mess up, you end up in the belly of a whale. And that's the idea that I had of God when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want nothing to do with him because I was sinning. And I knew, according to those commandments, I was going straight to hell. and I didn't want nothing to do with God. Matter of fact, you can keep your church. And God, if God is so wonderful, then why is there destruction in the world? Why are there women raped? Why are there kids messed up? Why is there people starving? Why are there wars? If God is so great, why doesn't he fix that stuff? God ain't right. God ain't it. Forget him. That's what I came to AA with. And I just remember resenting God. I remember when I saw the steps, I almost left because he had the word God on them. I couldn't take that. I couldn't understand that. And I'm dying on the floor of my room. And the next morning, I woke up and I had another reason to be mad at God because he didn't kill me when I asked him to. And I was just like, okay, you know. By Sunday, I was able to keep down some water. And I went to work that whole next week. And I wanted to use so bad. I wanted to drink so bad. And my parents would pick me up from work and they'd bring me home. And I would sit there and I would watch infomercials all night long, you know. Until 3-4 o'clock in the morning, I'd finally pass out for an hour or something like that, and I'd get up for work right away. 1-800-BOWFLEX, you know, SoloFlex was big, you know, the Thighmaster, you know, I'm watching this kind of stuff, and I'm like, just freaking out. Never mind, I could have went to a meeting, you know, that wasn't an option, because the only meeting that I'd went to, that I'd saw people that had something that was going on, was this meeting on Thursday, and I stayed sober till that next Thursday. And I walked into that meeting, and what ended up happening that day saved my life. What ended up happening that day absolutely saved my life. I came walking up the sidewalk to this meeting. And if you have people like this around you in Alcoholics Anonymous, God bless you. And God bless them for being here. Because I walked up that meeting, and I started walking up that sidewalk to that meeting, and there was a circle of people. You know, like you see outside of meetings. And they're smoking, and they're laughing. And I was just like, man. And there seemed to be this guy right in the center of the circle. And this is my perception when I was new. And I would put my hand on a stack of Bibles and take a lie detector test. That's exactly how it happened. And I'm sitting there, and I'm walking up, and the circle's there, and all these people are laughing and smoking. This guy is in the middle, and it was just beautiful. And it was, and I, because laughter, I wasn't around laughter anymore. Because I had destroyed everything in my life. I didn't laugh anymore unless an old lady fell down the stairs or something, you know? I was like, them and Slinkies have a lot in common because they're fun to watch. They're fun to watch fall down the stairs, you know? And I used to think that way. I was like, that's going to be great. I hope that person falls and breaks their hip, you know? Because if they're hurting, then I can, ha ha ha, and then I feel bad afterwards, you know? And I got a drink to get rid of that, you know? And that's the way I was. I was this sick freak when I came here, you know? And all the good people in my life that were around me, the well-meaning people, I didn't like them either, you know? And I'm walking up the sidewalk, and I'm like, man, you know, I ran out of this meeting last week. And it seemed like that circle around that guy just kind of went, and opened up like a door. And he came walking right down the sidewalk towards me, and I'm like, great, you know? They're going to throw me out, and I ain't even got here yet, you know? And what the guy walked down the sidewalk and said to me was like, he said this, hi, my name's Jeff. He put his hand out. He said, you're new here, right? I think I saw you last week. If he'd have said anything else, I probably would have swung as hard as I could and I would have left. I was so fragile and so afraid and so beaten down that all he did was welcome me to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first example of unconditional love I'd ever seen in AA. And I couldn't believe it was happening to me. Somebody like me, a nothing, a low-bottom piece of crap drunk like me. And this guy said, welcome. Nobody said welcome to me anymore. People didn't want me around. And I couldn't believe it. I was, and he shook my hand and he brought me up and started introducing me to people. And here it was, there was people that I had drank with in that room. And I was like, oh no, you know, these guys are lying, you know. And there was this guy, Gerard, that was there that in eighth grade, he had gave me a phony address and had me driving around all night to go to a party. And I saw him and I instantly wanted to kill him. And then I turn around, and here's this guy, Jeff. This other guy, Jeff. We call him Simmons. It's anonymity-wise, I guess. We call him Synonymity because there's no other... Everybody calls him Simmons, you know, and it's his last name. And he comes walking towards me. He goes, Kelvin, how you doing? And I was like, oh, no. You know, I drank with that guy. He took a loaded shotgun into a party to clear out the keg line, you know? I mean, that's the kind of people I drink with, man, you know? Line's getting a little long. Don't worry. Got that one covered. You should see people run. And it's free beer. I like people like that. And I'm like, there's no way this guy's sober. And then Jeff asked me that magic question. He says, Kelvin, how would you like to read How It Works? And I was like, what's that? And he takes me downstairs and he goes flipping through it and everything else. And it got down to A, B, and C. And just to let you know how desperate you become and then how much you want to insert your own will, I saw B and C and I'm like, can I just say 1, 2, 3 again, man, or something? You know, that's getting a little complicated. And we go through this meeting, and we're sitting there, and I read How It Works, and everybody claps for me and everything else. And after the meeting, my sponsor's real good about making newcomers feel comfortable. You know, he was real good about making newcomers feel comfortable. The best example I ever saw of this, we're sitting outside of a meeting one night, and there's this new guy there, and he walks up, and he starts talking to this new guy, you know. And all of a sudden, he's like, so where do you work? And the guy goes, Pizza Hut. Jeff instantly became 100% interested in pizza. All I want to do is eat it, man. I'm big, you know? I don't care about pizza. And Jeff's like, so tell me, do you guys get that stuff like manufactured, or do you still spin it in the back like they do in the movies? How many pepperonis is there on a pepperoni pizza? And this new guy is getting jacked. And at the beginning of that meeting, if you'd went up and asked him what he did for work, he would have said, I work at Pizza Hut, you know? By the time Jeff got done talking to him, he was like, I work at Pizza Hut! I am Pizza Hut, you know? And he's excited about life again, you know? And I saw that later on in AA, and what he did to me that night was, I remember this to this day, after the meeting, he comes up to me and he goes, man, when you read How It Works tonight, when you read the eighth step, a light clicked on for me, and I remembered exactly what it was I was missing about it, man. You helped me out. And I was like, I'll read every week if y'all want me to, you know? And he wasn't sponsoring me yet, but he's like, no, the other people need a chance. Just go shut up and sit over there. And there was this part of the meeting where they said, anybody willing to be a sponsor, raise their hand. And I didn't understand what a sponsor was, but there was a lot of people winking, you know? He doesn't have a sponsor yet. And doing that stuff, and I'm like, oh, I don't want nothing to do with this, you know? No, you know, leave me alone, you know? And these smiley, happy freaks in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Hi, living that live, welcome. Yeah, doing all that crap to you, and I just want to choke you out. Don't let go, let God. You better pray I let go of your throat, you know? Leave me alone. You know, people, because they were nice, and I couldn't handle nice people. I drank with people that peed themselves, you know? None of these guys had wet stains in the front of their pants, you know? And they're all hugging and stuff, and I'm like, you ain't supposed to hug, you're a man, you know? And it was just nuts. And all the sponsor talk, and afterwards, and this guy was wearing a tie, and he gave me his card after the meeting, and he said, if you need to get a hold of me, call me on this number. And then he asked me for my number, you know? And I think a lot of that gets missed, you know? It's like, here's my number, call me, newcomer, you know? Did you see me handing that guy my card, you know? That's what I used to do, and he was saying, no, man, you get his number, because you know what's happening with that number of yours? What, he's going to call it? No, he's throwing it in the trash. The second he gets home, get his number. And he got my number, and I looked down at this card, and it said Kraft Foods on it. And I'm like, that's a Fortune 500 company. This guy's in a tie, sponsorship. I got credit card debt, race cars. Yeah, I could use some money, you know. And I'm thinking that, and we get over to coffee, and I walk up to this guy, and I'm like, man, they're talking about sponsors and everything else. And this, man, this is great, you know. And I dropped this guy like 10 hints, you know, and I'm nervous, you know. I mean, I'm used to getting rejected by women by now because I stunk, you know, but I mean, I'm like kicking my feet, you know, and finally I just like, will you sponsor me? And he said, yep. And he said, but here's what I want you to do. And I was like, oh man, there's rules, you know, I just want some cash, man, you know, that's what I'm thinking. All I said was, what are they, you know? And he told me that we were going to meet. And he told me that we were going to go to these meetings. And he was going to pick me up and take me here. And that we were going to go to this stuff. We're going to go to these conferences. We're going to go do this. We're going to do the steps. And all I knew is that I didn't want to feel like I was dying anymore. And that anything felt better. Anything sounded better than the way that I felt right then and there. And I was willing to do whatever the guy told me to. Whatever he told me to. And I sat there and I was like, man, okay, let's go. And he started taking me places, and he'd take me out, and he'd pick me up. I was afraid, and I was paranoid, and I didn't want to be around a lot of people. And he'd pick me up in his car, and he'd drive me for hours. We'd get in the car and he'd just drive. And he'd talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, which is ironically where the Switchblade story happened. And see, but the thing that he doesn't know, and I've never said this to him before, but I didn't hear anything he was saying, man. You know? I was just sitting there going, rah. It was like Charlie Brown in there. Wah, 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 wah. And I'm thinking about how that new girl he wouldn't let me talk to, and I'm, man, you know, and I open up that knife just to clean my nails. I still do it to this day. You know, every time I do, I think of Jeff, and I'm like, and we started doing Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started getting me involved in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started going to these conferences, and we started doing stuff in AA, and my life started to get full of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were going to all these meetings, and we're going to all these places, and I'm starting to feel better, a little bit better, and I'm starting to get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and things are happening, you know, and it's funny when I get to this part of my story, it's always funny to me because I can always pick out the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics. When I say that I didn't know how to brush my teeth, really, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was filthy. I was dirty. I didn't shower on a regular basis. I was funky. And that he taught me how to brush my teeth. And then when I say, and today I brush my teeth all the time, and that, well, unless you were up really late, and then a cigarette will take care of that. But no, I'm just kidding. That I brush my teeth today, and when I call in sick to work, I'm actually really sick. When I say that, the alcoholics start nodding. They're like, yeah, man, me too. And the Al-Anons go. And then when I say, and I don't pee in corners anymore, and the drunks laugh, the Al-Anons get this look of disdain on their face. And they're like, man, I had to clean that up. And I know that the people are nodding at me are the people that I definitely want to talk to after the meeting, and the other ones are the ones I want to avoid. I always joke around and say that Al-Anon's a great program, and that's a wonderful thing. And as soon as I get some friends in AA, I might think about joining. And what I learned from Jeff was how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy wore his sobriety like a suit of armor, you know, and he'd shake anyone's hand, and he made people feel comfortable. And he would just stand there. He was the greatest example of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd ever seen, and the greatest person I'd ever seen. He just bore witness to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'd get around him, and I'd just be like, man, if I could only feel like that sometime, if I could only do that sometime, man, God, I'd be okay. And I'd watch him do stuff, and I watched his mom get sick in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd kind of become estranged to my family and his mother through Alcoholics Anonymous and the work that he had done there through the steps and the people that he had helped. She had taken me in kind of as her own, and she always gave me a big hug and I always said, "How you doing?" every time I saw her, and I watched his mom get cancer and start to die, and I watched him handle that with a level of dignity and grace and beauty that I had never seen before. He still answered the phone and listened to me whine about nothing. He still saw him at meetings, and he had every reason to just walk away and say, I gotta go, my mom's sick. No, he stayed in AA, and he did the deal. And I got to see things like that, and I got to see examples like him in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was excited. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I moved in and next to this girl in AA, and I moved in with a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was this neighbor girl, and my sponsor told me, move in with this guy in AA, and I didn't want to until I saw her. And I was like, man, this is definitely one suggestion I can take. And I had went through this neighbor girl turned into a romance, and I wanted to ask her to marry me, and I'd been really busy and doing a lot of stuff in AA, so I got a hotel room that night and did it right on Easter Sunday, and it's next week is Easter Sunday, you know, so I was about it and everything else, and what ended up happening was I didn't know when to ask her, and Jeff said, trust me, man, always ask him on a major holiday, that way you can never forget, Sponsor will help you out with anything. And so I had the sponsee of mine leave this, put this Easter basket. The first place we'd ever met is on the sidewalk, you know, right out in front of the apartment. So I came back from the hotel after this romantic weekend and dinners and stuff like that. And here's this Easter basket sitting there, you know. And I'm like, looks like the Easter bunny left you something. And she's not expecting it, you know. She's like, yeah, you know. Those things that the normal people give you, you know, don't you realize how much work I put into this is what I wanted to say to her. And and she opens up this egg, and this egg, this little plastic egg, and I had the ring in there. And by the time she grabbed the ring out, I was already down on my knee. Let me tell you how important sponsorship is to somebody like me. When I hit my knee, and she looked down, looking for me, and saw, looked down and saw me, and I said, will you marry me? She cried. She said, yes. She dropped down onto my knee that was up. And then all of a sudden, she backed up and had this look of shock on her face. She goes, did Jeff say it's okay? And I was like, yes, yes. And she's like, oh, I love you. And that marriage ended up, I moved down to Fargo in 1999. My sponsor had moved away and moved down to Fargo, and they were starting the Northern Plains Group. And I'd been complaining about wanting to come down there. And finally, it was like, put your money where your mouth is. We're starting a meeting in 3 weeks. Get down here. And I was like, all right. And I moved down to Fargo. And we started that meeting with 12 people. Jeff and Chad had become co-founders, and there was those two and 10 other of us. That meeting had 220 people at it last Tuesday night. And got busy in AA. And that marriage, that love affair turned into my wife got pregnant. And I wanted to be a good dad so bad, and I didn't know how. And it was ironic that he had just had a kid before me, you know. And I had everything. I had the person to go to for the advice. And I'm sitting there, and this is going on. And if the night I found out that my wife was pregnant, you know, I mean, I went out and I bought books, you know, and I'm reading What to Expect When You're Expecting, and. And yes, I will say this. My wife made me watch The Baby Story on TLC. And so I'm watching that, and I'm getting into all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, man, this is so wonderful. Baby. And I'm reading books. And I had read in the book that if you read to the baby hears your voice, that they'll understand your voice when you come out, when they come out. So I'm reading books to this baby every night. You know, my wife's sleeping, and she's starting to get big. And I'm tapping on the belly at 3 in the morning, and the baby's kicking back. And I'm like, oh, man, this is great. And my wife, and I know you find this hard to believe, but the baby was growing at this rapid rate. And they decided that 3 weeks early they were going to induce her because they figured that she couldn't handle the baby full term. And we get into this hospital room, and everything's going on, and it's just, it's happening, you know. And all of a sudden the doctor comes rushing in, and they say, every time your wife has a contraction, the baby's heart rate's dropping. And we're going to lose this baby. We've got to do a C-section right now. And I was like, oh, my God, you know. And up to this point in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had lip service for God in AA. Some of that resentment had been taken care of with the steps, and some of that stuff had been talked to me by my sponsor and everything else. But I didn't have a connection, not a true connection. But I told people I did because you guys were talking about God in meetings, so I was talking about God in meetings. Every other part of Alcoholics Anonymous I was doing except for the God thing, I still had... When I was new, I used my sponsor as my higher power, and to that day, he was still my higher power. I didn't have a true connection with God, not one that I could rely on. And I sat there, and all of a sudden, and my wife's allergic to latex, and they don't have a latex-free kit on this floor. And I'm freaking out, and I'm like, go get one, you know? And I'm getting all mad, and my mom's crying, and my mother-in-law's crying, and it's stressful. And I ran into the bathroom, and I'm sitting there, and I'm bawling, and all of a sudden, I hit my knees. Because my sponsor told me to pray. And what I've learned today is that it doesn't matter what my connection is. All that matters is I keep taking the action that a connection will eventually happen. And I took off on that, and I was just going, and it's happening. And all of a sudden, this latex-free kit comes up. Because when I was on my knees, I said, God, I can't do this. Help me.
and my tears dried up, and I felt calm for some reason. And I walked out of there, and this kit shows up, and we go over to the ER, and they're getting ready to cut her open, and they got all these blue tarps up. I'm like, this looks nothing like the baby story, man. This is not right, you know. And I'm freaked out, and this connection with God that I had briefly made in the bathroom on the floor was gone, you know. And I'm like, and all, my mother-in-law is 5'2", and they have these little diamonds in the windows for the surgery ward, you know. And all of a sudden, I see this little knock, these little knuckles there. And I open up the door and I'm like, yes, you know, like, don't you know I'm busy right now? For God's sakes, I'm freaking out. And she goes, Jeff's here. And I go, what? And I'm like, do you guys call him? We don't know his number. We live in Rugby, man. I mean, and he, around the corner he comes. And I'm like, baby's heart rate dropping, gonna die. And he puts his hand out and he touches my shoulder. First time in my life I'd ever felt the loving hand and touch of God. Ever. And he looked at me square in the eye. He said, go be a husband to your wife and go meet your daughter. I said, okay. I did. I went in there. And they ran this razor blade across her stomach and made the slit. And I went, that is not cool. And I'm a hunter. You know, I gut deer and drink the blood, eat the raw meat kind of guy. You know, and I was like, oh, this ain't good. You know? Oh, God. And they pull this thing, looks like an alien out of her. And I'm like, this is not like the baby story, you know? It's the only thing I can think, because the baby story, they're cute, you know? And they put the little pacifiers in the mouth, and that's where you see them in the blue cloths. And I'm like, that's an alien, you know? And they pull this baby out, and they have me cut the umbilical cord, and I'm like, guts, you know? And I cut this umbilical cord, and they take the baby over, and they put the baby under the warmer, and the baby's screaming, and the wife's gutted, and I'm like, what do? You know? I mean, right then is when you need a sponsor, you know? If he'd have came in at that point in time, like in surgeon scrubs, I'd have been like, this ain't right, you know? And all of a sudden, this anesthesiologist looks at me, and he goes, your wife's not feeling any pain, man. We gave her a spinal. Go meet your kid. So I get over there, and this baby's screaming, and they're doing, like, picking up her little legs, and I'm like, don't hurt her, you know? And I put my finger down in her hand, and she closed her hand around my finger. And I said, it's okay, Tiana, Daddy's here. And the nurses almost fell over when they saw what happened, because she quit crying instantly, and her head rolled over, and she opened her eyes for the first time, and that was the first thing she saw. And I love her to this day. She's the highlight of my life. She came out 9 pounds, half ounce, 20 inches long, screaming, full of attitude. I wonder who she gets that. Makes me wonder where she gets that from. And I'm going through stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm thinking everything is fine. Because I do the deal, you know. I go to meetings, I sponsor guys, I do everything I'm asked to do in AA. And I'm playing flag football, and I blow my leg out. It gets infected, all kinds of bad stuff happens, and I'm laying in the hospital room. And I've got a crater in the back of my leg. And they think that I'm going to lose my leg because the infection is spreading so bad. And I am pissed at God. God, I answer the phone at 3 a.m, man. I do that stuff. I go to meetings, I sponsor people, I do everything I'm asked to do in AA. I even go to the district, you know. Come on, you know. And I'm mad at God. God, I hated him. And I'm laying there, and this doctor comes in, this doctor, and he goes, man, he said, I'm not a religious guy at all. He said, and I can't even explain this to you, because just the day before, they had brought in these prosthetic legs, and were starting to show them to me. And he comes walking up to me, and he goes, I can't explain this at all, man. He said, but it looks like you're going to get to keep your leg, the infection stopped. Who comes walking into my room? With Corey, and comes walking up there into my room, and I'm having this spiritual thing, and I'm like, the doctor said I'm going to get to keep my leg, and he looks at me and he goes, do you know why? And I'm expecting to get one from him, you know, I'm expecting to get this spiritual, because you can walk Tiana down the aisle someday without a limp, you know, something. God wants you to walk Tiana down the aisle without a limp. He wants you to play football again, something. He goes, because your ego ate it, man. And I was like, what? You know? So I'm convinced that there is nothing that will live inside of my body because my ego will eat it. And I'm doing AA. And last year in January, my wife started getting this funky heart murmur while she was pregnant. Last year in January, I took my wife down to St. Cloud. And she had to have heart surgery. And everything went wrong that could possibly go wrong, and they had to put a pacemaker in. What happened from before until then is I wasn't mad at God. I wasn't mad at God. And I called my sponsor up, and I'm like, man, I feel guilty because I'm not afraid or worried or nothing right now. And he said, God's doing for you what you can't do for yourself, man. That's what's going on. And I was like, okay. And it was a crazy deal, and I was, God, I was doing Alcoholics Anonymous. Problem is, I was doing Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was getting self-righteous. I was getting full of judgment. And I was looking at all these other people in my home group and all these other people around me in AA, and they weren't doing it right. And they weren't doing as much as me. And if you're not doing as much as me, you can't say nothing to me. And that's where I was. I started getting right there in AA because I had this false conception of what I thought was God. Problem was, as I didn't have God, I was playing God. And there was no room for him to exist inside of me because God's a gentleman. And he just goes, all right, go ahead. Go ahead. I'll be here when you're ready. And I became God. And I was burning my life to the ground in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 7 going on 8 years sober, and I'm spinning the revolver on my .357, wondering if I should put a bullet in my head. And I want to die. And I felt like a fake member of AA. I felt like a facade human being. And I'd go here and I'd tell these guys, you know, man, resentment and this and this and that and everything else. And I'm resenting everybody around me and I'm judging everybody around me. And I want to die right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm burning my life to the ground sober. And I don't know what to do. Because my sponsor said, get in the middle of AA, man. Get in the middle of AA. I couldn't be more in the damn middle than I was. What is wrong with God? It's God again. It's his fault. Again. Because if I'm doing this to him, problem is I'm pointing at him and I still got 3 fingers coming back at me and I still don't see it. And I was dying in the middle of AA and I'm hurting people in AA. And it was coming crashing down and my wife looked at me and she goes, Kelvin, I love you. I love you. But I can't do this. You got to change something. And my little girl, the thing... Right before this, not long before that, I take her to daycare every morning, and it was just getting fall, and the moon was out still in the morning as the sun was coming up, and we came around the corner, and she goes, look, Dad, it's the moon. And I'm like, yeah, honey, it's the moon. And we have father-daughter moments like this all the time. I'm like, yeah, honey, that's the moon. And I take off, and we turn the corner. She goes, where'd it go? I'm like, don't worry, I'll get it. And I'm jumping on the accelerator, and I'm tearing around corners just so she can see the moon, you know. And I'm getting there, and she's like, Dad, it's the moon. I'm like, yeah, honey, it's the moon, it's the moon. And I'm so excited. And that night on the couch, she jumped up on my lap, and I was watching TV, and I was in self. And I said, get off of me. Leave me alone. And she started crying. And she said, I'm sorry, Dad. I said, you don't have to be sorry. Daddy's the one who's sorry. And I was dying in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could not figure out why. And I didn't have this connection. Didn't have this connection. And I tried to do it. And a guy by the name of Bob Darrell came to Jamestown to a roundup. And the guy started talking about feeling like a fake member of AA. And the guy started talking about how the funny thing about judgment is that you leave Alcoholics Anonymous one judgment at a time. And I didn't have a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous because I wouldn't allow anybody in close enough. And Jeff was in close enough to me, and I didn't have a friend. And Jeff thought enough of me, and Jeff loved me enough where he said, you know what, man, I'll be your friend. You need a different sponsor. And I got Bob to sponsor me. And my life has profoundly changed because I can see where the problem is. It's me. And Jeff had been telling me that for years. Bob showed it to me in the book. He started going through and doing Alcoholics Anonymous in a different way. And he opened up that book and he said, we're going to look at these resentments and we're going to look at these judgments and you're not going to do them anymore. And I came to my connection with God in AA like this. It's like I'm standing on a beach. and I'm looking around me in every direction, and I can't see anything, and there's a speck off in the distance, and I see that speck, and I'm like, what is that? And I start walking towards this thing, and I start walking towards this thing, and I'm like, that's not it, and I turn around. And there's times that I hit the ground, and I'm tired, and I sit down. And then you get this rock in your shoe, you know, and you get sand in your shoes, and kick your shoes off, and sand's hot and it sucks, and you step on something and that sucks, and you stub your toe, and it's a painful trip to get to this thing that I don't even know what it is. And I've been talking about it for 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even have a clue what it is. And I'm walking towards it, and I get over there, and it's hard. It's a tough journey. And when I came to it, it wasn't like I was running through a field of daisies like you see in the movie, and oh, I love you. You know? It wasn't that. It was like I glinted my eyes from the sun, and then. And I broke my nose on the thing, you know, just ran smack face into it. And I found it. And the funny thing is as I was walking towards it, all this stuff was around me. The job, the money, the wife, the kid, all of the success, the ego, and that was the stuff that all had to shine on. And I got over there and I got connected and I turned around and it took so long to get there and I started looking out at all the stuff with the shine. Funny thing is that stuff with the shine has a super highway of my self-will paved right to it. And a limousine of my ego picks me up and it takes me right there. And it drops me off and I start liking the shine. And I start looking at the shine. And I look back at that connection that I'm supposed to have and I see it and I'm like, oh, it's such a tough trip and I want to go back. Bob grabbed me and he pulled me back over there. And he nailed my feet to the ground and then told me not to untie my shoes. The funny thing that I've seen today happen in Alcoholics Anonymous is all that stuff with the shine on it that I chased for all those years seems like it's starting to move towards me some, and I'm not going anywhere. And I don't have to judge people today, and I don't have to hate people. I don't have to hate the smiley, happy freaks of AA. I can love them and call them my brothers and sisters. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you go through inconvenience, and there are people that get inconvenienced by Alcoholics Anonymous, and they do the deal in AA, and they get those gifts, and they go after the shine, and I was one of them. And I went after all that stuff, and I lost the focus. I lost what I was really supposed to be here for. And today, I have the wife, I have the kid, I have the job, I have the money, I have the success, I have all that stuff, and I use every single bit of it for Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability. And I don't play God today. On page 62 tells me, first of all, I had to quit playing God. And Jeff always told me to learn to be inconvenienced in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that's what we all learn to do and keep doing is be inconvenienced by AA so we can all grow in love and spirituality and love each other. The same unconditional love I was given when I walked in the doors, the same unconditional love I feel for everybody in this room tonight. Thank you.